Good afternoon, everyone. We're going to get started. So we want to welcome you to today's Lunch and Learn presentation for those of you who are joining us at AU Central as well as Illuminate Live. We also must inform you that today's Lunch and Learn presentation is being recorded and the presentation will be posted onto the Research Center website as well as AU Space for anyone who wishes to view it at a later time. Now it is my pleasure to hand the microphone over to Dr. Ken Manipwa, who will continue with today's presentation. Ken?
Well, thanks, Alice. So, good afternoon. My talk this afternoon is going to look at a dating technique called the luminescence dating. And it's a recent dating technique in terms of development. And we began to widely use over the last, say, 20 years, which is quite recent compared to other dating methods. So the presentation outline that I'm going to follow this afternoon will start with a brief introduction of the role of dating in geology, why we have to date in the first place. Then we'll go into the basics of the method itself, luminescence dating, after which we will have a look at the applications of the dating technique, where you can use it. Followed by, of course, fittingly, a case study in the place not so far from here, so that it will give you a better perspective of what you can use this technique for. So going into the first part of my presentation, which is the dating and geology, why we have to dating or the role of dating in geology. If you look at the classical definition of geology is the study of the history of the Earth and its life, etc., whatever. This is more of the older area definition. If you look now at the more recent definition of what geology is, it's that we call it the scientific study of the origin, history, and structure of the Earth. You'll find a lot of variations of these definitions if you are searching online of what geology is. But what I'm trying to emphasize on is the implicit in both definitions, or all definitions, is the dimension of time. So you'll find that assigning a temporal scale to gas processes is a fundamental preoccupation in geology. All geology inquiry is mainly focused on analyzing at processes in both space and time. So time is a very important parameter in all these investigations or inquiries in geology. So I'm trying to put my the dating that we are going to be talking about into context as to why we have to do it in the first place, because it's actually a basic ingredient of geology society. Now, the two main approaches when you are assigning an age in geology, you will get what you may call relative chronology, which is simply saying something is of a particular age with respect to another, or relative to another material or substance. An example of this, or the limitations of this method, I would say, would be, for instance, if I were to say Robert is older than me, what it says is very limited, and it will mean different things to different people. People who know Robert will know he's probably a few years older than me. Those who don't know me will not have any idea whatsoever, or don't know me and Robert. I may be 10 years younger, or 5 years younger, or 2 years younger. So it has a rather local limitation of constraints to it, and you can't use it broadly. Because you have to know both the elements which are being compared to in order to have a full view or full perspective of what's being described. The other technique is, or approach is called accident chronology, which is an age in numerical terms. So it's a numerical age of something. And this is easier to compare, it's easier to apply, it's more universal. But you will find both methods being used in geology for a number of reasons. You may have to use the relative chronology if you cannot assign a numerical age, because there's no way of defining it or elucidating on the absolute age. But if you can, it is preferable to have an actual chronology, because it enables you to describe your things more quantitatively. Now, why do we have to assign numerical absolute chronologies for numerical ages? Just for a very quick illustration of why we need to know numerical ages for how useful they can be. So, dating a judge will provide a temporal scale or time scale to our geological sequences or geological events. For instance, here we have a site, and during stage A, there is nothing which is happening. There is no material being deposited. In stage B, you have one unit, which we shall call the first unit. Sediment is deposited in stage B, then in the after which there is a quiet period, and you have a soil developing on top of that unit. In stage C, you have a second depositional unit, which is overlying the first one, and of course varying this soil level. For a geologist, it will say two things. There has been this is a sequence, there is a depositional sequence 1, change of environment, a soil forms, the deposition stopped for some reason. Then in the second stage we have deposition taking place again, after which it's a quiet period, a soil forms. Because soils can only be developed on a surface that is stable. If it's moving or if it's being removed or being buried, a soil cannot form. Now, dating enables us to give, like we say, a temporal scale to our profile or sequence. So in stage A we had nothing, in stage B we had one unit. So if we take a sample from the bottom of this first unit and we get an age from it, an numerical age preferably, we'll be able to tell when the dating actually commenced, or when the deposition, rather, when deposition actually again. If we have another unit or sample rather collected from the upper part or the top part of our depositional unit, say H1, this will tell us when deposition stopped. So already we have, so we have the first one was when it started. When it started, when it ended, and now if we are to determine how fast the events are taking place, we can take another age sample from here, sample H2, take another sample from the upper part, so we have two samples separated by a vertical distance. If we divide the vertical distance by, well, the age by the vertical distance, it gives us a depositional rate. So it gives us how that a rate of how fast these processes are taking place. So already we are having a story coming out of our sequence based on the ages that we're collecting. If we are to go again where we have the soil developing, we take an age from the upper part of units at the bottom, and another sample from the bottom of the second unit. This will tell us if there was any gap in the depositional processes, and also the age of our soil, how old is the soil, when did it form. And these have importance because we say the soil has an environmental connotation. It tells us there was no deposition. Also, usually, if you're dealing with wind deposit sediments, it tells us that it was not windy, there was no wind, and probably the vegetation was well developed because there was adequate precipitation. So it was humid, it was stable. So the soil is an environmental marker. It tells us something about the environment. Whereas the sediments, depending on what deposited them, they can tell us that the conditions were dry or probably cold if we're talking about Northern Canada or even Alberta. So we will talk about this in greater detail later, but we have environmental connotation and a time scale so we can reconstruct how our environment has been changing. So going back a little, because we were talking about luminescent dating, so just to put it into perspective, it's an absolute dating technique. And however, there are a number of dating methods one can come across. We have radiocarbon, carbon, argon, uranium, thorium. There are scores of them, and which all can give you an age. But the choice of your dating technique depends on a number of things. The most important of which are the time range you want to date. You can't date anything with anything. The time range you want to date will constrain what technique you're going to use. For radiocarbon, it's going to be less than 50,000. It has to be organic material. Many other constraints shouldn't have been exposed to contamination, things like that. So the main parameters here we have to be worried about are the time range you want to date and the dateable materials we have available. And so looking at luminescence dating, remember what we just said, these are some of the radiometric methods, these are the ranges over the quaternary period. Quaternary period is your last 2.5 million years or so. Debated. Some people say it's 1.6, others say 2.1, others 2.6. But that's been to play safe, let's just say about 2.6 million years. So these are methods which you can use over the last 2 million years, different techniques. You have uranium, thorium, proctinium, lead, 210, potassium argon, fish track, luminescence, radiocarbon, cesium, tritium. But you can see here, luminescence has quite a broad range. You can use it over pretty much this whole range. Realistically, actually up to around there. Up to there, if you have some conditions which are favorable to what's related, we will talk about those slightly shortly. So I'm just trying to point out to you that the luminescence dating has some advantages compared to other absolute dating methods, particularly its broad spectrum or broad range over which you can apply. And also, you can date it a number of inorganic materials which cannot be dated by any other technique. We're going to see that shortly as well. So that was our introduction to why we have to do dating. Now the dating technique itself. Luminescence dating is, as you can tell from the name, is a method that relies on the ability of some minerals to give light when they're stimulated. So if you excite the material, it will give light. This is what the technique is largely based on. Such materials are usually semiconductor materials such as feldspar or quartz. And fortunately, these materials are abandoned in nature. They're all over the place. Quartz is your most stable mineral at the Earth's surface. And fortunately, it is the best mineral to date using this technique. So it's quite a huge abundance. The fluke of nature slows here. and how exactly does it work. So if you have, we say, your false particle, it can give out light, but only if you excite it. So you have to use some excitation technique, and you get some energy given out by your pulse of those particles. And where is this light coming from? It's actually coming from energy stored within the mineral structure. It's actually from maybe a lot of people don't understand or appreciate that fully, but it's actually from the largest structure of the mineral grain. And deformity within the largest structure is trapped electrons which are displaced. It's actually from radiation, radiation damage which causes the displacement of the electrons which are trapped in lattice effect. Now, where is this energy coming from? We said, so it's energy stored within the mineral structure. Radioactive isotopes in the soil. So this energy is actually coming from surroundings of your particle. And it's radioactive isotopes within the soil or sand surrounding the quartz particle in the soil fall. Particles are receiving this energy from the surrounding grains or other grains within your soil. And these particles, the isotopes are usually your potassium, uranium, and boron. There is also, of course, cosmic radiation, which contributes a small component of energy to your to grains, but these elements are in very, very small amounts, so they are dangerous to humans. If we take that brick and analyze it, we'll find it actually has as well. Any earth material has those trace elements in it. We'll find it has potassium 40, uranium, thorium, but in very small amounts. And these radioactive isotopes are actually giving energy to the quartz and other particles within them. So they are accumulating energy as we speak. So one thing about this energy is it can accumulate in the grains, but if you expose it to light, it will go away. So light will remove this energy stored in the grains. Another thing which can remove this grain is heat. So if you heat these particles, the energy will go away. If you expose them to light, it will go away. So those are two stimulation mechanisms which can excite your grain and make it lose its energy. So for energy to accumulate in your grains, the quartz grain has to be shielded from light. It has to be protected from sunlight, or even any light, it's a mixture of sunlight, even that solar lamp and an electric bulb will do. So an important aspect of the dating technique relies on this property of your grains, that if you expose them to a stimulating source, the energy will go away. If you cover it, the energy will accumulate. And it's very important. So in nature, energy can only be stored in the grain when the grains have been covered by other grains. So we have a dispositional sequence here. We have our grains at the surface. No energy is accumulated because it's exposed. Energy is being given by the surrounding grains, but the sunlight from above is stimulating the grain, is releasing that energy, it's not accumulating. But if you bury it, there's no release of the energy. Energy is simply being stored in your grain. So energy will accumulate. That's the slide we're seeing, and it's blown up, so it's still better. So how do you obtain an age? So very simple. Before you obtain your age, you have to collect a sample from the field and take it to the lab, perform some measurements on your sample, And the two main parameters you're trying to determine, you're trying to determine the total energy stored in your sample. Because it says energy is carried from the surroundings of the sample from the radioactive isotopes. So we're trying to determine how much energy is stored in the sample. And then the other parameter we need is the rate at which the energy was coming in. How fast was this energy going into the particle? So when we have those two, we have an energy equation. Total energy stored, which we call our power dose. And then dose rate, we calculate it in the air, as you can actually come up with an annual dose. So dose being given out over a period of 1 year. So if you divide the total energy by annual dose rate, you'll have your age in calendar years. So you have an absolute age from that. And how do you measure the energy stored? You simply take your sample to a special laboratory and stimulate it so that it is released by the sample in the form of light, which is what I say. This is energy is accumulated and can be released by excitation in the form of light. And then you measure the energy released by the grain and it tells you how much energy was stored. So how do you stimulate? How do you make it release the energy? Because we take it from the field, it's got energy in it, we take it to the lab, we want to know how much energy is in the sample, we have to stimulate with a special technique. And how do you do it? You can heat it up to about 200 to 400 degrees Celsius. Then the quark particle will give out the energy in the form of light. Above that temperature, most of the energy will be gone, then it starts to glow, actually, turn red, which is not this kind of luminescence. It's more different than heat. But this is one method of exciting our grain. You heat it, it will give out the energy. And then the method of stimulating, if you remember, we say if you expose it to sunlight, all the energy goes out. So you can actually stimulate energy release using light as well. And so, but to do that, you normally use a special kind of light, say a green or red, and then you have a filter to remove green or red light there so that you're measuring light different from the stimulating source. But still, it's the same process. You excite your grain with the energy stored in it, measure how much energy is being given out, and then you know how much energy your particle actually stored. So the two main stimulation mechanisms, one by heating, and it's called thermoluminescence from heat, so thermoluminescence from heating, and light, which they call optically stimulated luminescence. This one is more widely applied these days. It's more accurate because it's actually identical to the manner in which grains in the field lose their energy. They lose it by stimulating, they lose the energy by stimulating by light, sunlight. Then they are zero, they have more energy accumulates. You stimulate them again using light in the lab, and you get a reliable indicator of how much energy was stored in between. So basic instrumentation for thermoluminescence, very simple and straightforward. This is your main apparatus, main measuring units. You can see you put your sample there, the same grain, very small sample holder about a centimeter across. You put about 90 milligrams on a sample of quartz, and then you excite it. The light given out goes into the photomultiplier tube. This is the photomultiplier tube. Raise the signal, goes through an amplifier, record it in your computer, and you can analyze it. So this is your thermoluminescence because you're heating a sample. OSL equipment, this is your light source, excites your sample. Light given out, photomultiplier tube. Again, you get the signal. This is your signal bar decaying of time because energy is going down as of time as you expose your sample to excitation. Basic TL voice reader, it's actually combined. It can do both. It can do heat excitation and optical excitation. So heat you can heat at the bottom, light, this is your light source. You can choose which one you want to use depending on the kind of dating you want to do. And the base, the unit is pretty small, very compact. You can fit on a table. And you can do your analysis and get your age. And this is your sample wheel holder. You can put probably about 60 samples on this holder, so it's turning as you do the measurement. And that's those are the samples there. Like we say, one thing we have to protect our sample from is some light, or any form of light for that matter, because it will excite the sample and we lose our energy. So all your working has to be done in a dark lab or in a dark room with no disturbances from light. So this was how we determine the energy stored. How do we determine the annual dose? So we say you need two parameters. One, the energy, total energy stored in the sample. And the other one we need is the rate at which the energy is being given to the sample so that we can divide and get our age. So the annual dose is several methods can be used to determine that. You can take a special instrument into the field to measure radioactivity of the material surrounding the sample. Alternatively, you can take your sample to a lab and use different chemical analysis techniques, that's atomic absorption spectrometry, nuclear activation analysis, or thin source, thick source alpha counting. These are different methods you can use in a lab to determine mainly elements or concentrations of the isotopes responsible for energy which is going to accumulate in your sample. Or you can do it, using also a gamma ray spectrometer, another instrument you can put in the lab, put your sample in there, it will tell you how much energy is being given out by a sample. So it will tell you what sort of energy or rate at which the sample was receiving energy in the field. Once you have those two parameters, you have your age. So the other aspect you're going to briefly look at is how do you collect the samples. We say sample has to be protected from light. You can't expose it. And the way to do it, you excavate or dig up an undisturbed section in the field. And there you will find a place where you can remove your sample. Because the important thing is not to work on a disturbed sample, because if it's disturbed, it means probably it was exposed to light, it's lost its energy, you never know anymore if it's got all its energy or not. And also, you don't know where that sample was actually relative to the profile, so it's not going to tell you a lot of useful information if it's been disturbed in some form. And then the push of the PEG pipe into the sediment wall. We'll look at that shortly, but say we're going to dig up a profile, excavate and expose an undisturbed section. This is an example of one. Exposed profile, best way available. If you have an exposed profile, which is actually open, good for you, because you don't have to work very hard. So it's easier to analyze. You can scan from a distance and do whatever you want to do. Also, it's easy to extract or remove samples from a profile which is open. Risk is of that is disturbance is a rate or possibility that your site has been disturbed is higher. You don't know who was there, who was not there, what they did, because it's actually open.
If you
can't find an open profile, the best thing is to excavate the pit or dig vertically into the ground to find an undisturbed profile. This is preferable in terms of collection of sample, because material is usually undisturbed. People don't go digging into the ground just to disturb surface. I mean, just to disturb the subsurface, unless they are buried something. And so the samples are usually quite in good shape. Drawbacks of that is takes a lot of work. You've got to be digging. And then you're also working in very restricted space. So if you want to work in more open space, you have to dig harder. You have to dig a bigger pit. And also, of course, there is a risk that you could be buried alive. So it's not very nice sometimes. Anyway, typical sampling format, how do you collect your samples, stage your pit, and you go up the walls of your profile collecting samples vertically, measuring your distances, because they're very important relative to your profile and surface, and also taking note of any environmental markers which might be in the sequence. The soil, for instance, this is the standard symbol for a soil, for a buried soil. So here we have some sediment, soil form. Later, some more sediments on top, and we are going to collect samples of, and we are trying to determine the age of the soil using those samples which are above and below, things like that. Again, we said we push pipes into the wall of your profile. There is your pipe, sample pipe. So we push it into the wall of your pit. And sediment will go in. Rumbling soft, it's not so hard, it's sand. Actually, 10, 15 years ago, they actually didn't do this. They would actually go sampling at night, or go with a big towel or cloth and cover themselves and scrap some material from the wall of the pit. I don't know why they did, because this is very simple, and I would have thought about that if I were there. But anyway, everybody's doing this now. It's pretty straightforward. All you do is push the pipe into the wall, and then you pull the pipe out there, and it's in between. Then you're going to work with material which is in between there. It's undisturbed. It's not being exposed to light. It's pretty straightforward. So after collection, you kept your pipe on both ends. A little bit of water is pretty good. Then we tape it, make sure no water is lost, because you need to measure the water concentrated sample, etc. So try to keep it as undisturbed or as unexposed to the environment as possible. And when it's like that, it's ready for going to the lab where it's going to be analyzed. Right, now how far back can you date using this method? It's a limitation of the technique because you cannot date things indefinitely, and you cannot date, say, something that's 2 million years or 3 million years old. And the reason is, like we say, the energy is actually being stored in lattice defects or defects within your crystal structure, and they are finite, so they get full. And once they are full or well occupied, your energy is not taking in anymore. Your sample, your quartz, your mineral is not taking in any extra energy, it's full. So beyond that time, your sample cannot just stay full. So here we have our what you call our growth curve. So this is dose received with time, energy stored. So it's going in, it's rising. And very interestingly, and rather fortunately, the growth rate is very linear, extremely linear in the first part of the curve. We'll study just how to start. between here and there. So linear, it is very accurate. It makes it easy to date. But beyond that linearity, we say it gets full and saturated. So the energy is full. It cannot take any more. So beyond that time, or when the brain is full or your matrices are all occupied, you cannot collect any more energy, so you cannot date beyond that period. And how old is that period? It depends on your dose rate. If your dose rate is very high, it gets full very fast. It's just like eating. If you're hungry and you're eating very slowly, it will take you a very long time to get full. And if you are eating very fast, of course, you will get full very fast. And this is exactly the same. Your sample has no dose, it's taking in energy, it will take a very long time to fill up if the dose rate is slow. If it's very, or if it's a high dose rate, you'll find that your sample will full very fast. And so the event you can date with a sample that fills up, which was in a high dose rate environment, you can only date a very short period. If the sample was in a very low dose rate environment, people can date the longer range. But generally, you can say you can date from about 100,000 to 300 or 400,000 years using this technique, depending on your dose rate. If it's a low dose rate, you can date up to 300,000, 400,000. If it's a very high dose rate, you can date up to about 100,000 years old. So, and from how early, you see the early part of your curve is not linear, so this is very difficult to turn around with, to date something very, very young, say less than, now they can date about 10 years. So something, say 5 years old, try to date with this method, not very reliable. But if it's something like from 10, 15, 20, you can get a good age from that. So from about 10 years up to about 200,000, you can get a very good age using this technique. Because that part of the curve is very, very linear. It goes in a predictable form. Circles younger than 150,000, okay, can give you a very, very good thing, up to 200 even. Beyond that, depending on the dose rate, you are dealing with something a little tricky. And so the next thing we're going to look at, we said, was applications. What can you date with this technique? So our basic requirement for dating using this technique is that energy stored by the sample should be zero, should be removed, should be emptied of any stored energy before you can date the sample. So basic requirement is the sample has to be zeroed by some process. It has to be emptied of some process. This is why it's not possible to go out and collect a piece of granite from somewhere and try and come and date it, because most granitic intrusions were a long time ago, because they're now lying at the surface and it took a very long time to be exposed. They are very, very old. You're talking about billions of years old. So you cannot date it using this technique because they are too old, saturated. The grave will just show you as very, very full of energy and you can't date beyond that. So you need sediment which is zero to some stage recently. One way in which they can be zeroed is by heating. If you remember, we said heating can excite energy and release it. So fire material like pottery, archaeological material, all of that fire bricks or tiles, baked sediments. The sediments are heated by some volcanic eruption. That can give you also a zeroing stage where the empty samples have no energy in them, so you can start dating from that point on. Another zeroing method is exposure to light. So wind transported materials are exposed to light, fluvial or river transported sediments, or exposed glacial outcrops or sediments that are transported by glacier also can be dated using this technique. So if any sediment or grains which were exposed to some zero mechanism and then buried because the energy has to accumulate and be protected from sunlight or shielded, can be dated using this technique. And also, of course, it has to have dateable material in it by quartz or feldspar. So if it's just clay particles with clay minerals in it, it may not be usable using this, dateable using this technique. So we said one of them is wind transported sediments. For me, this is, this actually is the most favorable material for dating using this technique. And why is that? It's because when wind transported material or wind deposited material is in transport, it's actually exposed to light very, very effectively. And so by the time they are deposited and buried, they have absolutely zero energy. There is nothing stored in them. So they are absolutely set to starting stage. So, and dune sands are very good for that because they're traveling at the surface. And so are silt deposits, if there are those of loess, thick loess sections. Well, loess is your very fine grain, 52 microns. And these are transported in suspension in air, so they have a lot of sunlight exposed to them. And so they too are very explosive. So these are the most reliable, the ideal material when you're dating using a low mass dating. So for a quick look at application or area we have a case study of where we have applied, where we apply this method. We'll look at Alberta, and we'll see that we can see that Alberta actually has quite a lot of wind deposited sediments, or these Neolithic sediments. These are all wind deposited dune structures within the province of Alberta, quite a lot. I wasn't aware of this before I came here, so I was actually quite surprised to find this. But there's quite a lot of wind deposited sediments in Alberta, and all of them are deposited after 21,000 years ago. So they're within age range of this matter. Can be taken very easily. And of course we say ice sheets because the ice sheets sort of scraped off all other sediments that were lying loose material. So the ice is sort of provided also a good starting point for material to accumulate. So whenever you see wind deposit material lying on the surface, it's most likely that these sediments are younger than 20,000 years. Again, this is 21,000 years ago. This is the ice sheets. So again, we'll see shortly. This is just a reconstruction from other people. Maybe it's not that accurate after all. We'll talk about it shortly. But anyway, this is what is the conventional wisdom is, conventional knowledge, is that at about 21,000, it is your max special maximum, last special maximum, and the ice sheets were at their maximum extent. Now, the objective of this study is to reconstruct environmental change central and northern Alberta over the last 20,000 years, and using these wind deposited sediments because they're datable very conveniently with luminescence dating, and also because dune sand indicate periods of reduced precipitation, because you can't have wind deposition during periods of heavy rain. Neither can you have wind deposition during periods of ice coverage. So there has to be no ice, there has to be very little vegetation covered, it has to be dry, and probably cold. It's dry up here, probably it's cold as well. It can be hot, but it doesn't be like it. So the lack of vegetation, lack of precipitation, and if we get some depositional chronologies, that will give us a very good time scale to how our environment was changing. And these records are from 20,000 up until the present, because if you look down in Southern Alberta, some of these have been analyzed and they've shown that they've actually been reactivated over the last, say, 10,000 years as well. So in various periods during the last 10,000 years, these have been very mobile because of reduced precipitation. But there is nothing, very limited data from central and northern Alberta because of many reasons. Lack of accessibility. So it's very important to look back on what we're talking about, that we can get environmental data, environmental information from our depositional sequences. We were talking about stage A, sediment deposited, stage B, nothing deposited, stage B, first unit, stage C, second unit, and then in between there was a soil. So whenever we go into the field, we look at the profile of our deposits and we can actually reconstruct, tell some story from what we are seeing. And it can have direct paleo-environmental or environmental connotations in our interpretation. And when we have chronology, we can assign a timescale to these changes. So why bother with the environmental reconstruction in Alberta? It gives us a more accurate long-term weather. A long-range environmental and climate change record gives us a good understanding of dynamics between landscape stability and climate. And of course, if you look at most of these environmental skeptics, all they talk about is if you tell them about global warming, many of them come back and they tell you, God, you don't even know what it was like 4,000 years ago. How can you tell me what it's going to be like in 100 years? So this is just a normal natural change, they say. And a handicap of people who try to argue back is actually they don't know what it was like 4,000 years ago in Alberta, or even 5,000, 6,000, 10,000 years. So when we have this data, it makes it easier to reconstruct these arguments and puts it all into better perspective. Another thing we need is it helps us constrain the timing of the retreat of the ice sheets. So these are our ice sheets. At some stage they're supposed to coalesce in between here, but slowly retreated, and there was an ice-free corridor there. The story is this ice-free corridor was used by the early settlers who were settling the Americas, coming in from to the Bering Strait, going down to the New Dalitians here. And they came across, they went through this ice-free corridor, which has been opened up. Because what you're getting here is you're getting archaeological evidence of people having settled here around 14,000 years ago. And yet, there were ice sheets here. So there must have been an open corridor between the ice sheets for them to be able to go through. So this is the story of the ice-free corridor. I will talk about this in a little more detail shortly, but shift now, or the current trend is that people are saying it was not possible to use this ice-free corridor because actually, if you look here, they say it only cleared up after around 12,000 years ago. So it was closed up until 12,000. So these people could not have used this ice-free corridor. They must have gone somewhere along the coast because of there was a coastal plain that was exposed during that period. So they followed the coastal route as opposed to an ice-free corridor in between, and there's a huge debate going on about that. So this, however, our chronologies which we're going to obtain from there will be a contribution to that, will, I think, change the debate slightly. So I would say this will help us settle the question of ice cream corridor thought by Sam in the years by the first unit to arrive in America. Exact dates are not known. our tech. We'll talk about a set message date during the process to ascertain the viability of this. So what we want is to at an age of when these children deposits were established, when did they start? What is the bottom age of these children deposits? Does it coincide or does it confirm the notion that ice only cleared out after around 12,000, this is with the radiocarbon ages, so it's actually about 12,000, it's only cleared out. So, part of the study we got to the Hornsby Smith area. The study will actually date all, well, most of these deposits in northern and central Alberta to come up with the chronologies for the deposition of these June sands. There's actually a large June field in the Hornsby Smith area, more than 60,000 square kilometers in this area. There are also many here in the Grand Prairie region, it's also down here in Hinton, that Anson area. Port McMurray area, all these areas. Actually, I was shown to this place by Don, so on the first trip we went together, Don and Mary, he's been working very hard. And we had to dig the vertical pits again because there are no, in most cases, there are no exposed profiles, so they actually have to go vertically down. On one site and one farm, Mr. Hayes in Mexico, he allowed us to fill around with one good June section on his farm. And we got an open profile, which is quite interesting, because it's quite high, for 10 meters high. And so we got very interesting samples from the bottom of this profile. I'll tell you shortly what the results are. And that's known as that. And of course, in all our excavations, what we're interested in is the undisturbed material. And it's very easy to tell. If you have that stratification, this linear bending, it means your sample is not being disturbed. Anything which disturbs will begin to remove that stratification. And then you know something has disturbed and it's no longer in good form. Results to date, the results from this area, the first set of results came in the range 9,000 to 13,000 years. And these are actually samples from closer to the upper part of our dunes. And my belief is if we go deeper, we're going to be able to collect samples from very low in the lower profiles of our dunes. We'll get ages which are probably closer to 15, 16, 17,000. And this is exactly what we're getting, because yesterday I just got an email from the second set of results sent to the University of Washington, and they're telling me they're getting an age, it's not final, it's just tentative, around 19,000 years old. Now this is, if this is accurate, it's a big problem, because around 20,000 years ago, ice is supposed to have been covering the whole of North America and Canada and Alberta as well. And around 18,000 supposed to be covering the whole of Alberta as well. Look at that, that's 18,000. But if we're getting ages of just that, 19,000 from these dunes, what it's actually telling you is there was no ice there. So ice must have retreated much earlier than the models currently think. And I think these models are wrong because they're actually not based on data, but they are modeling, they're models created using maybe data temperatures and extrapolations of data from other regions, but there's no ground data from even Alberta. So for some reason I feel this ice free corridor was supposed to have developed, this one there, it probably developed much earlier than the models are showing us, or than the current thinking at the moment. And these are the first results we're getting. These are the first absolute chronologies which are being used. And some of the earlier dates which have been used also range of carbon ages from organic materials. And those are not dating the actual events, because they're dating something which they're using organic material contained in the sediment to date the sediment. But in this case, we are not dating something, because we are dating the sediment itself, trying to establish when it was deposited. So organic material could have been introduced later, and it gives you a younger age. Whereas if you date the inorganic, the sediment itself, the quartz, when it was replaced, it's giving us an age which is much older. Preliminary findings or thinking of the drift is, I think ice is retreated earlier than is widely believed. And models need refinement. When better or more recent chronologies are put into these models, I think they'll come up with more realistic reconstructions. Because this data, these ice ones I was showing you from these models are actually from data from 1994, something like that, using ages maybe obtained in the 1980s. I think it's better to acquire more recent data using luminescence dating, because it dates the deposits themselves, and it gives a constraint on upper and lower age estimate for when ice should have retreated. So models need refinement. Ice recorded the fall much earlier than is currently thought, and I think if that is the case, then it's very ties in very well with the ages which are getting in the fossil and clotted area here, which shows that by the time you're finding archaeological artifacts dating 14,000, 15,000, it was pretty clear here there was no ice or lakes or anything blocking the route, because ice melted much earlier than is currently thought. And it made it possible for these early settlers to move along this corridor and migrate all the way to the south. Again, that's all that going on there. Anyway, so that's the preliminary findings from this study. But I think as we get more data, more chronologies throughout the province or better, it will give for central knowledge. It will give a fuller picture of both the changes that have occurred over the last 20,000 years, as well as the timing, in particular, the timing of the retreat of the ice sheets. Because for dune sands or dune deposits to form, the ice must have gone, but there was no ice anymore, must have retreated. And it must have been also dry, because if it was humid, then there would have been vegetation growing. And it must have been cool or cold, because if it was warm, probably there would have been vegetation growing as well. So we have cold conditions, dry, unstable landscape during the period when those sands were deposited. And the main thrust is to determine when they were deposited, when did they start, was it intermittent, was it continuous, and when did it stop. And again, the subject of the talk was luminescence dating. And luminescence dating is giving us the chronological dimension to this postures for a chronological scale to the development of our sequences. So I will stop for now.
Yeah, thank you.
If you would like to ask a question, please. Yeah. Yeah, if you look, I think most, if you look along the Athabasca River, there's quite a lot of dune structures along there. And I think these sands are coming from sediments from the riverbed, or from the floodplain of the Athabasca River. So as the ice sheets were melting, there was a lot of water moving down the river, and it would slide and deposit material on the floodplains, and these deposits on the floodplains would provide sand for the dune structures. In other areas, it might have been a glacier outwash. So melting material form, your glacier is traveling down with sediment in it, and it deposits loose material over the landscape. And when winds drown the moment of these materials and concentrate them in an area.
Why did you use standard coring techniques to get your samples?
Yes, very, very interesting. Good question. The problem is when you're coring, you are not sure where exactly your sample is coming from. And also there's a chance that your sample can break and fall back into the very difficult to actually, because it's loose material, very difficult to try and retrieve the sample which is that loose, as loose sand. There are people who use it, but many people are not very happy because you get a sample, yes, but actually you cannot tell the exact level where the sample is coming from. It might have dropped that down, or it might have mixed with other materials you're retrieving. So the most preferred manner of sampling is actually to clean the face and collect the sample and you know exactly where it's coming from. But if it's used by some people, that's great.
I have another question about temperature
increases with pressure. So is there a point at which this technique would not work because samples at different levels would actually have different, some with this closer to zeroed out than others?
Correct.
Well, the temperatures you're dealing with are, because it's your standard geothermal gradient, it's something like what, 2.5 degrees per 100 meters. So you would need a very, very thick section for you to reach about 200 degrees. Because you only start zeroing your sample from around 200 degrees. So it has to be very, very deep and very hot. And normally, when you have a sample like deep, I mean, if you can go down to about 50 meters, you're very, very lucky. And there, your temperature is still less than 50. So the temperatures never get that high enough for you to stop worrying about your sandals being at zero.
One more question, and that is, how quickly would the demo be zeroed out just by exposure to sunlight? Is it instantaneous, or does it take a while?
Very interesting question as well. Sunlight probably very, very rapidly. I would say within the first 10 minute, it has lost about 60-70% of the energy. By the next, because it's so decaying exponentially, and by about the 10 minutes, it probably has almost 90% of the energy gone. And then about, you're talking about 15-30 minutes, there's probably just a residual those left in it, about less than 5%, which you can't remove anyway. So it's rather rapid. 30 minutes, by 30 minutes normally your sample has nothing left in it.
I have a question online. I'll just read it here. Excuse me. A question from Frederick online. And when you use the OSL technique, you said that green, red, or infrared light is used to stimulate the sample to be gated so that it releases energy. So Frederick is assuming this energy is released as light energy or cold light. What is the wavelength of the released light energy? Same as the primary source or longer, shorter wavelength?
What you do is it's a mixture of wavelengths actually released by the sample. But to you actually use a filter to separate the stimulating source from the emitted light. So where you are having your light going out of your from the sample, you actually put, say, if you use red light to stimulate, you're going to put a red light filter above the sample, so that your sample or the signal detected by your measurement equipment excludes green light or red light, depending on what light source you use to stimulate. So the important thing is to use a filter to discriminate between the signal source and light emitted from your from the sample. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure to answer that question.
If I could comment on that screen here, if you can use either red or green and filter it up, that means it's down below the green, so it's blue and indigo and violet up above.
Mm-hmm.
The radiation is emitted when you release it. If you can use a red or a green and filter that out, that implies that the radiation is being emitted from discharging it.
Right.
It's below that.
So right.
Sorry, when I have the same thing, it actually was the opposite reaction. I actually have the same question as Gregory. I just wanted to know what the actual wavelengths of the machines were. If they use the deep infrared, for example, or roughly where in the spectrum these fall in.
Emissions of the
luminescence.
It depends on your material. If it's quartz or if it's feldspar, and of course it will depend on what filter you're using.
Well, maybe I guess it's just an interesting question. We're interested in knowing exactly what range that is, because it falls back into what kind of things are actually luminescent, which is my second question. Sorry, Ken, I'm not clear as to what is actually luminescent in the sample.
What is it?
Like, what is it? Is it a heavy luminescence, or is it something that is fluorescing, for example?
No, it's energy being released by you mean what exactly is actually giving the luminescence? It's actually electrons are reflecting back to untracked position, and so that energy is being emitted as light.
Okay, well that's really wild, and it's something I'm not familiar with. I'm sorry, I don't know where in the spectrum does that come out as an emission. Just roughly, is this deep infrared radiation that is being picked up by the instrument, or is it microwave, or is it actually invisible from the spectrum?
It's visible.
You can actually see this thing?
Yes.
Wow.
It's within the visible range. You can see it. The first discoveries of was actually a guy who took, I don't remember what mineral it was, and he put it to his body, and it warmed it up, and he saw it glowing. So it's within a visible range. But it's so so low, you can't see it if you're going to put it in the room, because it will sort of be swarmed by say daylight or summer. So you can't see it. But if you were to put it in a dark room, yes, it will be visible in the visible range.
Robert the Elder here. One of the things I was wondering about is the contaminant. Say if you're working with quartz and it's mixed up with a little bit of iron or magnesium or something else, how does that affect the results? Does it skew the results at all, or is it just the lattice structure of the quartz crystal that holds the energy?
If you have, sorry, the contaminants?
Well, I'm just thinking, if with quartz, it's never often not perfectly stained chemical compounds. There's some quartz and white quartz and I don't know what else quartz. Do the chemical contaminants or the variations of the quartz make a difference?
Well,
I get back to, I was thinking of when you get ranges, it's plus or minus 2%, plus or minus 5%, plus or minus 10%.
Well, the reality is the behavior of your grains will be slightly different from place to place. So you'll find some quartz which behaves, which gives a very good signal, and other quartz which gives a rather poor signal, but it depends on the contaminants within the lattice. But when you're dating, you're not interested in what contaminant is it, what you're interested in is it gives a signal. So it will not affect your result as such at the end of the day. But they will behave differently depending on the contaminants inside your lattice. That's correct. If they are never, the contaminants inside your in your quartz might not be the same. Different concentrations, different as actual contaminants itself in the quartz, but it will not affect the dating you're doing, because what you're simply interested in is what energy was stored, how much has been released. But there will be variability between different types of quartz. Like for instance, the long conventional belief has been that the quartz in Alberta or in Canada does not give a good signal, something like that. Actually, it's not very true, because some people work with it and quite a signal, but it's difficult to work with still compared to other quartz in other areas. And it's less probably because of the region which it's coming from and the contaminants which are in this quartz.
Thank you.
Another one off topic, but I've been doing some reading on the glacial events. Is this fit with the same dates of when they've been dating the deposits that have been left behind by the glaciers? There's a famous erratics train, the one that comes down the foothills that has been dating.
That's the one. But
yes.
I think they're using cosmogenic radionuclide.
How good?
Cosmogenic.
Okay, and what kind of
dates do they have? Well, they are very approximate, because they are simply coming up with an age of when they think some boulders were exposed to cosmogenic radiation. And so they say the age they're getting is about 11,000. And so about 11,000 years ago, they think the ice sheet separated, the collaring on the west and your laurentite to the east. So up until 11,000, the two ices were merged, and then from about 11,000 years they separated. So using the erratic boulders, they have an age of about 11,000. I think it's a very approximate technique. It's very, the error range is very high, and it doesn't give you a very accurate age of work. And in any case, the boulders, what you are dating is when the boulders separated from the main cliff they came from, and you are not too sure when that happened. So there's a huge error component involved in that.
Okay, so that's it. Well, thanks, Ken, very much for your presentation.